Okay, thank you for inviting me. What strikes me when I attended those talks here was the variety of systems which are display glassy properties. And then I feel that it's necessary to try to tell you what kind of problem more specifically we're looking at, and the systems we are considering are structural glasses. Essentially amorphous material, a large part of this work was motivated by the study of granular materials, and there are also we have currently works on foams, on simulation on foams, and colloidal suspension are clearly a system we can address in short poly, and also I will probably discuss some experiments which involve short polymers. And all those material are structural material which interact with short-range, essentially repulsive interactions. And the theoretical question will be what can we guess just by excluded volume effect, which are due to the fact that there is a short-range repulsive interaction between a set of molecules. The question that we really want to address are to understand flow equation for complex fluids. For example, we would like to be able to know what's the velocity profile inside a granular flow down an incline. So another question that we would like to address is the plasticity and fracture of a material. For example, we would like to understand why a material is brittle and why another material is ductile. Why a granular material has some sort of ductile behavior, and your window glass is brittle. So of course they are glasses, and of course we have these universal ideas that tell us that they should be similar. There are definitely similarities in the system. The point, what we want to understand it, what is what differs, and can we design some very simple flow equations in order to be able to address some of those issues, even though the whole statistical physics and the first principle derivation is not available. Another problem that we're looking at is what happens in earthquakes, and earthquakes are essentially controlled by the friction law at the interface between between the rocks. In an earthquake fault, you have a very thin layer of material, which is essentially sort of very finely ground granular materials, and the property of this material control the way energy is dissipated from the fault and radiated from the fault, and control the dynamics of earthquakes. So what we want is to be able to have simple constitutive equations that we can plug either in order to understand flow for a complex fluid, or to understand some emergence of fracture and localization of shear deformation in a material, or to understand what happens in an earthquake, or what happens in a sheared layer of a lubricant in a friction law. Essentially, in order to do that, we need to know, to understand very simple setup where you have a simple material which is uniformly shear, and understand its response in different experimental protocol like constant stress. So you have a piece of material, you apply a stress. If the stress is below yield stress, it's known that the material doesn't flow. If the stress is above yield stress, the material starts flowing. Constant strain rate, when you apply a material at constant strain rate and you see the stress response, and in particular, a very important problem is the instantaneous stress response, the way the system converges towards equilibrium, and also the relaxation of the stress when we perform a step in the strain of material and see how the stress response relaxes. So the problem is that the situation we want to consider are strongly out of equilibrium situation, when a system is sheared, for example, or when it's going to break up. So we need equations which allow us to address strongly out of equilibrium situations in a very simple framework. And of course, we'll have to resort to some very heuristic or phenomenological approaches in order to try to get some partial understanding of those materials. I will remind you of some phenomenological models of the glass transition, like the free volume and NIBM's model, and also some works which have been done in glassy solids. I will first make a sort of review of past works in those areas, and also I'll present you, I don't know if many of you are familiar with those radial state equations, which are very much used in order to understand friction or to understand earthquakes, and even to try to understand fracture. Then I will present you a heuristic argument which I believe allows to write in a very with very simple assumption, that at least very established assumption, very rather clear assumption, how some radiant state equations can be written for the deformation of to understand to account for the constitutive equation governing the deformation of a dense material. And then I will show you some of the consequences of these equations and what we can attempt to do on this basis. So the original one of the first attempts to understand glass transition why the Cohen-Turnbull free volume theory, the idea that what they were trying to understand was the Vogel-Fercher expression for the viscosity. And they came with the idea that in a glass, the rearrangement were not activated by temperature, but were activated by something else, by free volume, as they call it. Just think that there are simple, small defaults in the packing of molecules, which allow one molecule to enter a hole and to diffuse in the system. And that leads to write a time scale as an exponential of 1 over some mysterious free volume, and that might be plugged in that will is often used in order to argue of a strain rate in a dense material. There are further assumptions that Cohen and Tribble do on this free volume in order to because they want to account for this Vogel-Fercher expression, and they do it simply by arguing that free volume vanishes at non-zero temperature, which is something that is a very strong assumption. A second and very important phenomenological model of the glass transition was given by Adam and Gibbs. And it relies on the idea that, in fact, the rearrangement shouldn't be seen as one molecule going in a hole, but as the deformation of a cooperative zone. I mean, it does not involve one single molecule, but it involves a whole zone which changes its state. That leads to then to argue that the size of the zones should scale as one of a configurational entropy. The idea is simply that if the system as a whole, if the entropy of the system is decreasing, then in order to find a subsystem which has two states, then you need to have this subsystem which is increasingly large. And because of that, it leads to an expression for the activation factor which involves the configurational entropy here, and that leads also, that allows them to account also for Vogel-Fercher expression for viscosity. And it turns out that this expression in some cases can be used to fit rather well experimental data. In a very different subject, people try to, so in a very, wrote some equations that I will call radiant state equations. This work was initiated by experiments by Dietrich on rock friction. So he looked at the frictional property of, so he has two rocks which he's sliding at a given velocity and looks at the stress response when the velocity changes, when the temperature changes, and so on. And what he observed is that, first of all, that the friction, which is here solid friction, is velocity dependent. And in fact, also that it's not only velocity dependent, because there is a, but that in order to account for this friction law, it's absolutely necessary to introduce a state variable. And he doesn't try to identify the state variable by simply writing that the stress is a function of the velocity and of some state variable, and then proposes some, Roina proposed some equation for the state variable, which involves, and it turns out that those equations are used commonly in order to understand earthquake dynamics. And they are not really physical, because physical you would expect that the strain rate is a function of the stress and on variable which might be the pressure, the volume of the system, some state variable which might account for the structure of the system, for a free volume or for whatever. And the stress here is just, the equation for the stress here just comes out from the elasticity of the material. This is the overall strain rate of the material, and this is the plastic strain rate. And plastic rearrangement occur with some rate which is given by the internal state of the material. So the problem remains, in order to try to write constitutive equations for dense materials, we know how to start, we need to define this function, and then we need to to estimate the equations for the state variable of the system. So the question is it possible, is it simply possible to account for the deformation of a glass in material simply by adding some state variable, a few number of state variable, and then address some more complicated problems. Those equations, sorry.
So what would you have in mind for five, what would be a typical example?
Well, a typical example, the point is that there is no really typical example. I will discuss you what I propose for phi, but there are, okay. Phi has been, in rock on rock friction, people have discussed that phi might be associated with the surface at contact between the two materials. That has been used by Caroline Bomberger in dry friction experiment, and to understand dry friction experiment, it turns out that even in dry friction experiment, and they have recent results which show that in fact what determines the stress response even in dry friction might be in fact the plasticity inside the asperities. So it's not really the surface at contact, but it might rather be the properties, the rheology of the material inside every single asperity, which tells, I mean, after years of studying friction by considering it was the number of surfaces in contact, then people realize that it might not be, it might be something completely different. So Carlson and Battista used this, wrote some sort of equation of this form in order to understand boundary lubrication. Boundary lubrication is a situation where you have some interfacial material between two surfaces, you shear it, so you have a very thin layer of material which is sheared, and you can measure the stress response as a function when you pull this on the system at a given velocity. Here, they just don't even try to identify the state variable. They just say there is a state variable, and we go with it, and we see what we can do. Aronson and Simring use this same kind of equation for granular materials. And what do they say? They say, okay, this state variable tells us whether the system is solid or liquid. So we have a state variable. They don't try to identify microscopically the state variable. They just try to have something which tells them about the solid or liquid-like feature of the system. Ruina originally had, his state variable might be identified to an age of the system. But that's it. There is a more recent work by Derek Ashdari and Leke, who applied the same kind of picture for soft glassy materials, like colloidal suspensions. And they identify the state variable with, in fact, they don't identify a state variable. They have a, they introduce a state variable which is a fluidity, which is the inverse of a viscosity. So, I mean, everything is put in this state variable, and they don't try to identify that at the microscopic scale. They just try to say that there is a state variable and to see what the consequences are of this assumption. There is another idea which came in works on plasticity, and this idea is that this idea arose from observation in numerics. That the deformation, the plastic deformation of the material occurred in localized spots. And then people thought, okay, if it occurs in localized spots, it means that there are some zones which shear, and then the plastic strain rate is the density of zone times the net number of forward jumps per zone. And that might lead to identifying some possible state variable to account for the deformation of such a system. Volkelanger in 98, from those ideas, and knowing also the rate and state formulation, consider that the number of zones of different types oriented along different axes of the stress tensor might be a potential state variable in order to write constitutive equations. So they write the plastic strain rate as a net number, that's the number of forward jumps is the number of zones, say, oriented like that, which are likely to shear in one given direction, times the probability that they do so, and minus the number of minor zones and the probability that they shear backward. And that gives a plastic strain rate. And then it remains to write the population dynamics for those zones, which they propose like that, simply by the flips between the zone and some mixing term. And they write, as Speppen and Argen and as others, they write activation factor again as an exponential form, which involves, again, a miraculous free volume. Just a matter of saying that the activation processes are not thermally activated by something else. So, okay, so there are several, actually, the work that I'm going to present to you arose from the remark that if we expect that activated processes are activated by something which is not a temperature, but which is, say, related to density fluctuation, then obviously this should vary as the system dilates or contracts. And we know for sure that in those experiments, we know for sure that if you just put a glass and monitor its enthalpy as a function of time, you see that there is some small compaction of the glass. That's a very, very common feature. We know in granular material, for example, we observe very easily dilatancy when the system is sheared. And obviously, this quantity here should vary as a function of time when the system dilates and contracts. Therefore, it is an obvious candidate for a state variable. It turns out that it has never been considered as a candidate for a state variable. So the original question of that work was, okay, what could be the consequences? I mean, what happens if this now is understood as a state variable and if this quantity evolves in time? This quantity is not, it's a very, in the equation, this quantity has a very specific position. It is like a temperature. So now if this effective temperature varies, what happens? In fact, I think there is an easier, a better formulation of those ideas. And this formulation is, okay, suppose that you have a system and that I have a very large piece of material, and I expect that, I assume that the rearrangement processes, first of all, I assume that macroscopic quantities like the volume, like in a constant pressure ensemble, or like the strain of the material, evolved by changes in those metabasin in a very complex phase space. The rearrangements are expected to occur in localized spots in the material. That's something which comes from numerical observation. And it means that there are some, I can subdivide the system on zones and ask the question, what's the probability that a zone somewhere in the system is going to rearrange, to change its state in order to allow for the volume or the strain to evolve, to vary. The first question is, suppose that once I have identified those zones, the energy and the local volume occupied by the zone is a fluctuating quantity. And how are those volumes and energies distributed in the system? So if I draw, let me just draw a picture. So I have a very, very large piece of material, and I can separate it at a given time. If it's a glass, it's evolving very slowly. If it's evolving very slowly at any time, I can separate, I can identify some molecules and follow and track them for some short time interval. So the question is, first of all, the local volumes, and I'm not talking of free volume here, I'm talking really of the volume occupied by some number z of molecules. The first, an important remark is that the system exchange energy with, this system is in a constant pressure and constant temperature bath. Of course, it's not equilibrated with the bath. I mean, it's trying to equilibrate with the bath, and we're writing a question for how it equilibrates with the bath. It equilibrates with the bath when a rearrangement occurs. If no rearrangement occurs, if it doesn't change metabasin, it does not equilibrate with the bath. And it's very important to realize that, in fact, all those zones, even though they, on some interval, they might not exchange any energy with the bath. They are just fluctuating in their metabolic basin, and then the volume changes up or down. So if I consider some short time interval when the system is not rearranging, is not undergoing is not exchanging any information with the bath that allow it to know that the temperature is lower than its temperature, during all those times, all those zones are in contact between themselves, and they obviously exchange energy simply because the system is close to mechanical equilibrium. If just a very, very change, a very slight change in the position of one molecule allows to change the volume occupied by one zone and the volume occupied by another zone, which means that in a material, in a structural material, because of elastic forces, if I subdivide the system in small zones, those zones exchange energy between themselves at timescales which are much faster than the timescale at which the system exchanges energy with the bath. Another way of understanding that is that the small exchange of volume between various zones can be accomplished by very, very small displacement of the molecules, and therefore they are accomplished by performed by acoustic modes of the system, and those acoustic modes propagate at a velocity which is the sound velocity, which means that the typical time at which the system equilibrates in the space in its spatial extension is very fast. When a rearrangement occurs, some energy is exchanged with the bath, a local reconformation changes, and some molecules moves here. And what happens is once this very fast movement has occurred somewhere, then the whole system adapts to this new movement. And there is a very, and that's something which is observed, I mean, in numerics, for example, that you see a very short time rearrangement. And right after this rearrangement, there is a very fast propagation of stress, so that the stress of the overall system accommodates the new, what has happened inside the zone. So this leads to assume that if I want to estimate the distribution of all the local volumes or all the local enthalpies of the system, the local enthalpies are equilibrated between themselves. The ensemble, this distribution at every given time tries to maximize its entropy in the absence of any contact with the thermal bath, in the sense that between two rearrangements there has been no contact in the thermal bath. Nevertheless, the system, the energies, the distribution of energies in space tries to equilibrate. And that leads, obviously, to say that the distribution of enthalpy should be given by an exponential distribution, which comes out from maximization of the entropy of this distribution at a constant volume, not at a constant temperature, but at constant pressure and at a constant enthalpy. And when you write the partition function for this function, you just get some expression. And now it turns out that this Lagrange multiplier here is directly related. I can just define a temperature by writing that the Lagrange multiplier is 1 over k theta. And now theta is a function of the total enthalpy of the system minus some constant term, which comes out from the fact that I need to integrate, I cannot integrate below some volumes simply because of hardcore repulsion. That's this calculation, this V naught is a frivol, this is a boundary which arises, for example, when you derive the van der Waals equation. It's exactly the same thing. So, is there any question at that stage or any reaction? The point is that, the point is that if I monitor the volume of the system as a function of time, it fluctuates like that and sometimes drops when a rearrangement occurs. So what I want to account is for what happens between the rearrangements and between the rearrangement to know what is the distribution of local enthalpies. Between rearrangements, H is constant. And therefore, the only way I can estimate the distribution of those zones is by maximizing the entropy at constant enthalpy, at a constant total enthalpy of the system. It turns out, when you write that, that first of all, that the activated, we expect right now, but the calculation needs to be done, we expect the processes to be activated by the local fluctuation of density, and or the local fluctuation of density to play a role in activated processes. But now this quantity obviously needs to be a function of time. So let me. So now the relaxation of theta and the relaxation of the total enthalpy of the system is just a sum over all possible jumps, all possible local rearrangement of a zone. It involves here the density of zones at enthalpy h, and here the jump and the contribution of the jump to the variation of enthalpy. And in general, there should be some added term here which accounts for the work of external forces. The point now is that we try to estimate this here, making the simplest assumption, and the simplest assumption will be that those transitions are activated processes in a dense system, and that they involve a barrier h, and that this barrier h is a function of the local volume available in the system. If there is space, the molecules can rearrange easily. If there is no volume, the molecule cannot. This function cannot be an increasing function of the volume, simply because if there is more space, then it's easier to rearrange. So it's non-increasing function. And as it's a non-increasing function, it means that you have the barrier h as a function of the volume, which may be anything. And it means that there is a volume, Va, such that the PVA is equal to the barrier h at Va. So what it means is that if you think of a very large system, and you look at all the density fluctuations in the system, and now consider that there is one function of the volume which tells you what the barrier h is, then for small volumes, you indeed have the enthalpy of the system, of the local system, is below its barrier h, and above here, So I have a system with enthalpy h. I want to understand how it goes to enthalpy h prime. The picture I would like to draw is something like that, and say that here it's h, here it's h prime, which is different, and here there is a barrier h, which depends on the volume, hence of the enthalpy of, say, both subsystems. And I want to account for all possible transitions in this simple framework. The problem is that this cannot be an increasing function of h and h prime, which means that there necessarily are systems, places in the system, where, in fact, the barrier has melted in the potential energy landscape, and where one of the two is above the barrier. And that's something which is seen in numerics. When you look at numerics, that, for example, there are many numerics by Lax, who shows that the transition, in fact, may be understood by the fact that a barrier, in fact, disappears. So it's not really an activated process, it's a process which is not activated because the barrier has disappeared. So if you perform this, so given that, we understand that there are two types of pathways that need to be identified. First of all, there is the situation, the standard situation, where you have two h and h prime which are smaller than their barrier. And then the process is an activated process. And the local rearrangements are processes which are exchanged with the thermal bath and which are activated by the temperature of the thermal bath. Otherwise, we have a problem, because there is something here that, we have, here the barrier has disappeared, And the only way we, or one of the way we can write the transformation rates is by using Monte Carlo weights and by saying that the probability of transition is a minimum, is one, if H prime is smaller than H, and it's this in the other case. And then we can do the calculation. And what comes out from this calculation is the following. What comes out is that, sorry.
Have some event that takes place. Imagine I'm in some quantum static
right,
state.
Right.
Then presumably everything is locally in some local minimum.
Absolutely.
And then some event takes place somewhere.
Right.
Now I scan through the rest of the sample and there are new barriers, but some of the states and some of the regions are no longer in local.
Exactly. That's exactly it. Okay. And that's exactly the contribution of that we are considering here. So the point is that an event occurs somewhere, then the local enthalpy, the local volume needs to redistribute slightly, which may make some local zones to now have a barrier which disappear and be likely to rearrange. The point is that it's important to perform this integral completely in order to understand what's the contribution of those. And what happens is that if you look at the dominant terms by performing this integral, you see that, so you can identify, so you simply separate this integral by the integral over those rearrangement and the integral over those. And what happens, so let me call I1 the integral over this condition, and I2 the other. What happens is that when theta is close to t, which is the situation when the system is very close to equilibrium, the contribution of the first integral goes at theta minus t square. And that's due to the fact that the barrier, in fact, the motion is diffusive because the rearrangement processes here are just a function of h. I mean, it's known that when you go over a barrier, you have a diffusive process. Here, you have a system which goes as theta minus t order. Now, in the case when theta is much larger than t, which is the situation when the system is not equilibrated, the temperature is very low. What happens here is that the first process is dominated by an activation factor which is thermal, and here this one is dominated by something which is activated by theta. So what it means is that in both situations, when theta is around t or when it's much larger, the contribution which dominates in this equation is the contribution of those non-activated rearrangements. So there are activated rearrangements in the system, but what dominates the process is the number of places which, because of the local transitions, are led to a state where the barrier has disappeared in the energy landscape. And when you just see this dominant contribution, we arrive at an equation for theta, which is of this form. Here I have just considered that the work I anticipate on what I'll be doing later by considering that the work of external forces will just be produced by shear forces. But what's important for now is this term, which comes out from the previous calculation. I made an additional assumption here that only changes h minus h prime equals plus or minus delta q were allowed. And in fact, it doesn't change. I mean, you can integrate over the whole range of h and h prime. It doesn't change anything. So now what this equation tells is that, first of all, so in the absence of stress, the equilibrium, the thermodynamic equilibrium, is a solution of those equations. This equation tells you how the distribution of local enthalpies, which at every time are supposed to be distributed by an exponential form with this effective temperature which comes out from the maximization of entropy. So what it tells you is that now I can reduce the whole relaxation towards equilibrium by the dynamics of theta. And equilibrium, of course, is a fixed point. But now the way I go towards equilibrium, the prefactor here is a function which decreases with theta, and therefore if theta goes to go to a temperature which is very low, then this is very small, and therefore the process of equilibration is very slow. And what you can do now is, starting from this equation, vary the temperature and see what happens, for example, in a steady cooling experiment. What people do, they take a piece of material and they cool it at given cooling rate and then go up, and then perform the same experiment at another cooling rate and then go up. And what you see is something like that. So the enthalpy of the system, just by integrating those equations, here you have the line which corresponds to the equilibrium. In this situation, I mean, I just made no assumption that the equilibrium should be anything else than kt, than theta equals t. What happens is that the system at a given cooling rate, so I'm cooling here at a given cooling rate, here I'm cooling slower, and here I'm cooling slower, and then I'm going up. Here, at high temperature, the system manages to adapt to the given cooling rate and adapts its temperature to the temperature of the bath. When the temperature is going down, what happens is that theta becomes far from T, from equilibrium, and then you see this that enthalpy doesn't manage to go on the equilibrium line. And of course, if you go, well, you understand that if you go slower, then you can reach lower values of the enthalpies. What's interesting is also to look at the heat capacity, as people do in experiments. In some experiments, at least, what people do is simply they integrate those curves in order to get the heat capacity, because this is the derivative of H with respect to temperature. And what you see here is that when you go down, you have a very sudden front, a very sudden change in the heat capacity, which is due to the change of slope here. And when you go up, you find a very sharp peak. And this peak is what was known as Kovacs memory effect. And it's, to me, it's extremely surprising to be able to capture that just at this level of simplification. And we see that, you see that the different peaks depend on the cooling rate. And if I am an experimentalist, I just have this data, I try to estimate the glass transition by the maximum of the peak, then I will claim that the glass transition depends on the cooling rate. So what's interesting here is that we have very simple equations which allow us to capture this kind of temperature dependence of an effective glass transition, cooling rate dependence on an effective glass transition. Now, if I consider the zero temperature limit, or the limit where theta is large compared to T, and this occurs, in fact, in large part of the zone, not only when T is zero, but anywhere where you are out of equilibrium. So if theta is much larger than T, then the equation reduces to something of this form, and it tells you simply that theta relaxes as 1 over log T. And okay, so that's just for the relaxation of this single variable. Now, a question we want to address is what happens when the system is sheared, and what's the relaxation, this relaxation of the system towards equilibrium. So if I have a piece of amorphous material, which is a glass, I know that its energy is out of equilibrium, it's evolving a long time. The question I ask is, what is the very direct consequence of this simple fact? Just the fact that the enthalpy relaxes, and therefore that I may expect that the density fluctuation evolve, the distribution of density fluctuations evolve. I account for that in the simplest possible way. And does it tell me something about the response of the system to shear? And does that resemble somehow what's seen in experiments? For that, I need to do a very similar calculation, just to say that the strain rate is a result of activated processes. And here again, the dominant term is given by theta. And here I've just linearized the relation between stress and strain. Here, note that I put delta H prime. And here there is an assumption, which is that the reactional pathways that correspond to a transformation, an elementary transformation of shear, or an elementary variation of the enthalpies, may in general differ. I mean, I have no way to know whether that it's the same. I mean, both are transitions between metabasins, but Locally, if I want to picture a shear transformation, I would picture it in one way. If I'm trying to picture a local compaction of the system, I would picture it in a different way. And therefore, I don't know how to do the calculation, but I expect that if I could do the calculation, those activation factors may differ, or even slightly, but not be equal. So what now are the consequences of this coupling with shear? A remark before is that I could use the shear transformation theory that Jim Langer presented during the conference. In this case, instead of having here sigma, you have sigma minus delta, where delta is another state variable which accounts for the anisotropy of the contact network, the number of minus and plus zones. And then you need to provide an equation of motion for delta. And the interest is that it's possible to understand what happens when you have one state variable or two state variable. Are those state variable equivalent or not? Do they say something different? And that's questions we are addressing right now. But let me just, I will not discuss this today. I will remain with this expression and simply look at a relaxation modulus, which is what you measure when you do a step in the strain at a given age of the material. So at a given age of the material, you apply a strain step. This strain step induces an elastic stress in the system with mu, the elastic constant. And after, when you hold the system, some plastic rearrangement occurs. And because of plastic rearrangement, the stress relaxes. It relaxes proportionally to the number of plastic rearrangements. Just by using the previous equation, now we find that the modulus, which is the stress as a function of time divided by the amount of stress you put in the system initially, so it's the linear response of the stress, and it turns out that this linear response is a stretch exponential. And that again accounts, it's very surprising to me to get that in such a simple framework here. The stretch exponential relaxation simply comes from the fact that the rate at which activated processes occur evolves in time, relaxes in time, because there is an underlying state variable which itself is changing its state. It is relaxing. The exponent beta of the stretch exponential relaxation is related directly to the ratio of barrier 8 of the two pathways. And again, it's observed, there experimentalists remark that the beta exponent may vary when you consider different processes, when you consider different observables. It might well be that a part of what we observe of the beta of the exponential relaxation we observed is due to the fact that there are two different pathways which are that different observables use different pathways and therefore evolve different barrier 8s. So if I just integrating those equations here, that's 1 over theta as a function of time, of log time. You see here it goes as a logarithm. So that's different relaxation modulus I can have for different E0 over E1, which are simply just time constants here. And that's just to show you that those equations, despite their simplicity, display very, very rich behavior. And they account here for a crossover between an exponential and a stretch exponential relaxation. It's possible to see what happens when you vary TW, so that's different systems with different ages. You have here a system which is a young system with small TW, which relaxes where the stress relaxes exponentially. There is a crossover here that you see from exponential to stretch exponential relaxation for an older system. And if you plot that with increasing ages, you find here that there is an aging exponent which is non-trivial, which is 1 minus beta. It's also possible to use those equations to see what happens when you force a system by an oscillatory shear, and it turns out that you even see some sort of extremely non-trivial features on the spectrum. And all this is just purely dynamical. And of course, it raises a question, which is the problem that in the experiments, the system is not at equilibrium. So it's really important to be able to understand what what happens just by the simplest evolution of by the fact that the system is dynamical. It seems to me important to be able to see if that may account for a part of the experiments, and if we need to more complicated arguments in order to understand those problems. If you look at the steady state of a material at high temperature, you have a viscous liquid. When the system is close to its equilibrium, it's a viscous liquid, and the viscosity is given by Arrhenius. At low temperature, the stress is a power law, is a power of the strain rate. And with the power of the strain rate, which is directly related to kappa, which is again this ratio between different barrier aids. So it's interesting here to remark that this n of the power law rheology is directly related to the beta exponent of a stretched exponential relaxation. Those are two different experimental processes. In one case, you have a system, you apply very small stress, and let's see how it relaxes. And here, you're doing something completely different. You have a system, you shear it very strongly, you go to steady state, and you see how the stress depends on the strain rate. So that's a very clear prediction for relation between the power law rheology and the exponent beta in stretch exponential relaxation. Given the data we have, it's very hard to say that it's wrong. But of course, it would be, in order to check that, it would be necessary to have a continuously varying family of materials. Well, some material where you can change the for example, if you change the polydispersity of the packing, you may expect that this kappa changes. And it would be very interesting to be able to relate those two exponents and to see if there is any systematic relation, at least, between those exponents in real, for example, in colloidal suspensions. With SDD theory, you may have a more complicated expression, which here, so here, the interest here is that the system displays a yield stress. Okay, so let me finish with one illustration, some more examples of what we can do with those equations. That's a surface force apparatus, which is a few hundred meters from here in the lab of Jacob Israelashvili, and that's a picture that Delphine Gourdon gave me. So here you have two mica sheets, and between the sheets you put a very small layer of squalene, for example, which is a short polymer, which is glassy at room temperature. And you can shear it and measure how the force as a function of the driving. And of course, there is a very complicated problem here, is that you cannot separate that the apparatus has a given stiffness, and you cannot consider that the plastic strain rate is constant. You're driving it at some strain, you're coupling the response of this material with the elasticity of your experimental apparatus. But in the contact, what you essentially have is that you have this material with these shears. It's very interesting, I think, from a theoretical point of view, because a big problem to understand the experiments on sheared glasses is that there is a localization of the strain. You know that, I mean, that's what leads to fracture. When you shear material, the strain doesn't go everywhere. It's not uniform in the system. It's localized on the boundary or in the center of the system. It's not uniform. That's a few nanometers thick.
You're saying that there's a shear band?
No, I'm saying that it's so thin that there cannot be a shear band. And that's why it's very interesting. Because then I'm looking inside the band, and since I'm looking inside the band, I can plug directly my equations, which are completely homogeneous, and try to see if it works or not. Experimentally, it's possible to see by interferometry what the thickness of the system to be able to characterize the layering effect. Layering, it's what happens when it crystallizes. That's not what we want. But in squalene, it's possible to perform those experiments, and Delphine has performed beautiful experiments where she see that for wide ranges of forcing, the system remains amorphous, and so it's truly a glass which is sheared at a thickness which prevents any localization, and that's very interesting. Those were results obtained by Carlos Drummond and Jacob Israel-Ashvili, and you see that at large velocity you have the force as a function of time. And at low velocity, what happens is the system starts to do stick slip. We see that the force goes up because essentially the interface doesn't shear. So you're pulling on the system with a spring, and the spring elongates as because it sticks. And then the system slides, and again and again. And it's really it's possible. I mean, you can see here that's the force as a function of the velocity. And that's a very weird cycle. So you see here the force increasing at the zero velocity, then almost at constant force, the velocity rises up and then goes down. And then the cycle continues. And this transition, I mean, then we can look at many different phenomenology of how this transition occurred. That's a very interesting subject. The equation I've presented to you, what they might give is the following, that in a zero temperature limit here, temperature, as you see, just mostly modifies some constants in the equations. Here you see that, so here I'm looking at different constant strain rate experiments. So I have a system, I share the system at a constant strain rate, and it's coupled with some elastic constant. For different strain rates, what we see that the stress goes up, and then the system yields, and when it yields, the stress goes down and reaches a steady state. That's a very, very common feature observed in those experiments, observed in many amorphous solids, many solids. At low velocity, those equations indeed account for a transition to stick slip. And in fact, it's more, so that's, yeah, that's, okay, some more stick slip. And this is the cycle you saw just before. Here is the force as a function of the plastic strain rate. So just let me go here. So this is the cycle. And from the equations, I'm slightly lying to you because I had an exponential form for the stress here. But that's the cycle you can get just from the equation, just doing absolutely nothing. I mean, it just comes out like that. And it's extremely similar to what you see in experiments, and which means that those equations are true candidates to really be able to compare with experiments and to try to fit experimental data and see what's wrong. Okay. So, in conclusion, I have shown you how it's possible to write equations which allow to crossover between viscous liquid and a glassy material. It seems to me that that's really interesting. I mean, I started by, I was originally interested in granular materials, and for example, if you want to understand a granular flow, you need to have a constitutive equation which tells you about what happens when the system is at low granular temperature and very dense, and when the system is at high granular temperature and dilute flow. And you need something which dynamically can account for that. And it's something we really need. That's, first of all, it responds to something which is important to be able to address more complicated problems. But I also think that it may have some more theoretical reasons, and it's very surprising that it works so easily, and one question which strikes me is whether in fact a large part, at least in short-range repulsive structural glasses, whether a large part of what we see might not be due simply to the fact that there is a single state variable which relaxes. We get those stretch exponential relaxation of stress with an exponent beta, with an edging exponent, which are related to power law rheology, and all those exponents are related to a ratio of different barrier eights, and that raises a question, which is, can we estimate those barrier eights? Can we calculate those barrier eights? If we could, in principle, we can guess beta, we can guess n, can we observe a systematic relation between beta and n? The equations which are current works are study of boundary lubrication, of stick slip instability, a very detailed study. We are trying to go towards the experiments, and I think it's the first. This set of equation is it's the first equation that can really account for such a wide range of experimental phenomena that we can really think of trying to compare it with experiments. And that's very exciting. It's possible to address problems related to data latency in granular material. That was, in fact, the original motivation of this work. And now I have some equations that it's possible to look at granular flow down an incline, for example, and try to see what data latency effects and what the rheology of the system. It also provides, those equations, in fact, provide expression which, in some sense, unify this work on plasticity with trivial inactivated processes, which have a very similar form of the rate and state laws which people use in earthquake dynamics, so that, for example, we can add, first of all, we can argue of those rate and state laws and provide them some better grounding. And more importantly, it may be of relevance for earthquake dynamics because, for example, a large part of the complexity of earthquake dynamics might be due to the fact that inside the mantle there are gradients of temperature, and therefore there are gradients of the rheology of the material, and all those different friction laws which interact. It's very recent observation that might be one of the reasons why the earthquakes are sustained. So that's something that we can directly look at right now. And finally, the question that I should ask you is there more theoretical grounding for the fact that a single state variable, a single scalar variable may account for class transition?
Thank you very much.
We have time for questions.
Yes. Do you know this granular bouquet in Lubensky?
Yes.
There is an extra variable there that is something like temperature, I guess. Can you see any relation?
Well, it's a viscosity they use. Mm. And yes, there is certainly a relation because there is a problem. The problem is that the way they write their argument is that they make assumptions which pertain to dilute granular materials. So, the basis of their equation is really subject to discussions. Now, adding this viscosity, yes, indeed, that's what it does. Those equations, precisely what they do, is that they account for viscous flow in large temperature and for this power law, which may be a decreasing, which may be a shear thinning or shear thickening for a dense flow. So that's a way to argue of, one original motivation was, as I said, for data latency in granular material, and more specifically, it was to be able to do what they are doing, that they try to interpolate between two extreme behavior. The point here is that I interpolate, but I have equations which interpolate. So of course it's a candidate now to look at the same problem.
Your equations are noiseless. Can you get noise vectorizing generalization as well?
I suppose so. That's a very, very interesting issue. I also suppose that there are some generic systematic way. Once you have rate equations, we know how noise should be added, and also those equations derived from rate factors. So normally there are some systematic ways to know what's the noise which comes out from these kind of rate equations. So yes, indeed, that's something which should be interesting. It may be important for example, when you, in thin flows, when you have effects due to the finite size of the system, the interest was to have a starting point.
One. If I understand the theory correctly, it's a mean field theory in the sense that there are no spatial correlations built in between the rearrangement effects. Can you imagine elaborating the theory so that you then had fields that lived on space evolving in time?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. I'm not sure I agree by saying it's a mean field theory. In some sense, there is an assumption here which is just the opposite of mean field. In mean field, you separate the system in many small pieces, and each piece sees the whole through the mean field. So here it's the opposite assumption in the sense that I'm considering that because of elastic contact between those small pieces, every element, every zone, first of all, equilibrates, I mean, sees all the fluctuations of the system, they equilibrate, and therefore it's now an intensive quantity, which becomes, it's not the whole distribution, but it's another quantity which becomes the relevant variable. And that's due to the fact that I'm considering that, in some sense, the fluctuation equilibrates in the system. But now, of course, then I'm making the assumption that, so in some sense, that induces some coupling already between the transformations. Now, yes, of course, you could, and that's probably, now, for example, a simple extension would be to now introduce an equation for how the rho, this distribution relaxes, how it maximizes its entropy. That's also a dynamical process. That's not, I'm assuming here it's instantaneous. But I could say, okay, now a rearrangement occurs, and now the system tries, the zones, every zone tries to slightly shift its energy by trying to minimize, locally maximize an entropy, and then that would lead to other equation. And we can elaborate that in many, many different directions.
Further questions or comments? If not, let's thank our speaker one more time.